Can you hear me? Okay. Great. Before we get started, just a couple of housekeeping items. One is we will be having two dinners. They're optional dinners for you, Zeke and I, during this fall semester. One will be in October, in early October, and it will deal with the healthcare reform as reflected in the presidential debates. So we'll be talking about that at around the time of the presidential debates. I think the date is October 9th, Andrew and I think it is. After class. So the other dinner will be closer to the election, and we'll be again in November 5th, and we'll be talking about the election. By then we ought to have a pretty good idea of when is election day. The day out. So we should have a pretty good idea, we think, what the outcome of the election will be. So that's just for your interest. Enrichment gives us an opportunity to meet with you in a smaller, more informal session. Second thing is, and I know a lot of you aren't here today, hopefully the rest of you will watch this on tape, it's really important that you have those clickers. That's a requirement of the course. We will expect everybody, if you don't have them today, by next class, to have them with you. I really think it would be a very good idea if you have it with you when you come to class. I would not come to class without it. It's not very expensive. You can rent them. It's a hell of a lot cheaper than a textbook, which you don't have to have for this course, but it is a requirement of the course. Zeke went over that on the first day, and so we do expect everybody to have that. Okay, so today we are talking about healthcare reform, and we're talking about quality of care today. And this is the sort of the pre-ACA lecture. We'll be having another session after, when we get into the second half of the course, when we talk about what the Affordable Care Act will do for quality. We talked about in the past that we have this iron triangle of healthcare, where we're trying to optimize access, cost, and quality. Zeke talked about cost a couple weeks ago. I talked about access last week. We're going to be talking about quality today. So that's important for give us a sense of perspective. What are we going to do today? Well, let's start off with an example. You are a semester abroad, vacationing, whatever, in Oxford, England. You're playing tennis. You suddenly develop severe pain in your right knee, and you cannot walk unassisted. How do you decide where to go evaluated, knowing very well that you may need surgery? Okay, so those of you with your clickers, give us your best shot. Would you go to the nearest emergency room? Would you go to the student health service, assuming they have one? Would you go to the largest hospital? Would you go to the best orthopedic hospital, busiest orthopedic hospital? Or would you ask some local students who you've been playing tennis with where they go when they have a problem? We should have Jeopardy music here for the daily final Jeopardy. Okay, polling's opened. 23 responses. Is there anybody here who has one of these that hasn't voted yet? Okay. Like I said, next class, everybody really needs them. Okay. How'd you guys vote? 30 would go to the nearest emergency room. No threshold for pain among that group. A quarter would go to student health service. 9% to the nearest hospital. 9% to the busiest orthopedic hospital. 22% would ask local students. Okay, who wants to tell me what they thought and why? Whether or not you had a clicker. Yeah.
I'd say student health service, just because if you did have insurance, and it was Oxford, you
probably that would be true if you were in the United States, but I don't think they really care about. I have a friend who is just in Edinburgh for a wedding, and one of the people there had a syncopal episode, was taken to the emergency room, received all the top quality care. At the end, they try to give them their insurance information. They said, this is the UK. We don't take insurance information. So you're thinking to get care, you may have to go first to be seen by a local provider.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So student health services are unlikely to have emergency care, and when you get there, they'll probably say, go somewhere else. They'll send you to an emergency room or something, because they're not going to have the access. Yeah. go so straight to the ambulance room, straight to the emergency room, because it's a single payer system and you have an emergency, you don't have to go through any triage.
You're judging by student health here. Student health is probably not going to help you no matter what you and also the fact
I'll leave this one off the tape. Go ahead.
And also the fact that student health is so far, and if you really can't walk, mm-hmm. I mean, just by our campus, I know we have so many hospitals close to us than student health services.
Okay. Now, those are all good points. We're going to go back to slides, and you see what this says, quality of care. I want you to think in terms of what we're going to be talking about, quality of care. If you're interested in receiving the best quality care, how would you make that decision? Yeah.
I would go to the busiest RCCA hospital because they probably have a very high volume. If there's an association between higher volumes and better outcomes, there are a lot of different
Okay, so... What's your name?
John.
So John said he'd go to the busiest orthopedic hospital because the busiest orthopedic hospital is likely to have the most experience. There is a volume outcome relationship. We know that people in medicine, we know that high volume providers on average tend to do better than non-high volume. Whenever you talk about averages, just remember what statistician once taught me, only a fool would go wading in a river that had an average depth of 4 feet. So averages can be misleading, but all things being equal, if you needed to make a decision and you didn't have information, that would be a reasonable place to go. Any other thoughts? Who said ask local students? Yeah, why'd you say that?
Because they might have had an experience.
So they might have an experience, either a direct experience or an indirect experience. Somebody, they may know who the so-called better places are. Not better places are. Who said the largest hospital? Yeah? So for a lot of the reasons in the busiest orthopedic hospital, volume, they're used to seeing a lot of things, they're used to handling a broad range of problems. What would you like to know, whether or not you know it, what would you like to know when this happens? Yeah?
Outcomes and how the provider is reimbursed. So you have an idea of how much you're going to pay out of pocket.
So you'd want to know how much you're going to pay out of pocket. What would you want to know? Yeah. I'm sorry, what? How soon you can be treated. A woman after my own heart. No pain threshold at all. I want it now. Yeah? So when you, outcomes information about what? About the surgical procedure. How long it's going to take you to recover? What are the chances you're going to get better? Will you regain total function, normal function, etc.? What else might you want to know about outcomes besides the procedure? Yeah? You want to know about hospital and acquired infections or other complications that you might get while you're in the hospital that may or may not be related to the procedure. What else? Yeah? Yeah, I'd like to know how good the doctor is. Has he ever seen this or she's seen this before? How many of them have they done? Do they have good judgment in deciding whether I need surgery or I can be put in a knee immobilizer and get better by myself? And how good are they? Yeah? And you'd be interested not only in the surgeon or the department that's going to be taking care of you, but given the fact that everything that a doctor or a nurse or any provider does to you has some risk of harm as well as some risk of benefit, there may be other unanticipated problems that come along. You want to know they have the capacity to do that. Can you get that information? Can you get it immediately? Can you get it non-immediately? If this happened to you at the University of Pennsylvania, could you get that information in a reliable, valid, statistical, objective sense? Anybody know where you could for knee surgery? I'm not sure you could. There are some conditions that you can get some information for. You can get information about coronary bypass surgery in certain states, including the state of Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. You can see how good the doctors are and how good the hospitals are. But that information is not always updated annually, and it's subject to some difficulty in interpretation. And I think we'll give you the opportunity or maybe an assignment to go to a website, try to read that report, and see how helpful that can be. So there are some surgical, limited surgical conditions for which you can get this information on some varying timely basis in some states of the United States. But in general, when it comes to making quality decisions, we're often flying relatively blind, depending on referrals from others who have had the procedures or had the experience or interacted with the doctors in the hospitals. How reliable do you think that other information might be? Anybody? How do you make decisions right now about go to see which physician? Anybody here ever needed to see a specialist, and how'd you make that decision? I won't ask you what specialist or anything. Yeah. What? Who's the best? Did you ask them where they'd go? Or where they send their mother? That's a typical thing. Where would you send your mother? Nobody ever says, how much do you like your mother? But who's the smartest? Who's the best? I don't care about smartest, to be honest with you. I know lots of smart physicians I wouldn't want touching me. Yeah. I have a switching specialist. What? I have a switching specialist. Mm-hmm. And what did you not like?
Typically, you have to do the right thing. So, especially the specialist, you need more of a response
time. So not very so responsiveness to you and your concerns and your needs weren't always met. Mm-hmm. Interacted. How many people here have had experiences with physicians where they have had good communication between? How many people have had experiences with physicians? It could be the same people where there hasn't been good communication. Okay, so it's not uncommon. These are some of the aspects that go into assessing quality. These are just some of the things that we're concerned with. So let me tell you what we're going to be doing today. We're going to be talking about five things. The first thing we're going to be talking about is, let's see if we have chalk here. Yep. The first thing we're going to be talking about is, what is quality? We're going to define it. How is it defined? What are the components that comprise quality? The second thing we're going to be talking about is, how do we assess? How do we assess quality of care, good quality? What are the metrics that we use? Third, we're going to talk a little bit about how does the U.S. healthcare system stack up in terms of quality? And lastly, we're going to talk about what are the causes of poor quality and how can we improve it? So what are some of the causes? Of poor quality or of high quality. And last, how can we improve quality? How might we improve quality? Let me tell you what we're not going to talk about today, just for time. We're not going to talk about some of the initiatives, some of the efforts that have been made in the healthcare system thus far to try to improve quality. We'll get to that when we talk about what the Affordable Care Act does in terms of trying to improve quality. We'll do a very quick survey then of what some of the efforts to date have been and then how that has changed by the Affordable Care Act. I was thinking about doing it today. I was originally planning on doing it today, but there's too much other stuff I wanted to get in. And I thought it would be more meaningful if we had it at the same time. We're going to see how the system changes right beforehand at the same session. We'll talk about what's the status quo, and then we can easily see how that's being changed. Excuse me. So, what is quality of care? What are some of the parameters you're interested in? Just let's randomly, you can just yell them out. What are some? You said you ran through them before. What are some of the factors? Good outcomes. What else? Yep.
Availability
and communication. Good what clinical skills? Good technical care. Doing the right thing and the right person in the right way at the right time and hopefully getting the right outcome. What else? Good follow-up. You can do everything right, but if we don't do the follow-up, everything might fall apart. Anything else? Yep. Volume is sort of a way to get good quality, but yeah. Yep.
Support.
Medicine is more than doctors. How many people here are nurses? Nobody here today. One. But you can have the smartest doctor in the world. You don't have good nurses, you're not going to end up with good outcomes. Vice versa. It's a team. Everybody brings something different to it, and patient care today is complex. It's multifactorial. It involves biological, clinical, social, economic factors. You need to put them all together to get a good outcome, and every member of the team provides something that's important to the care of the patient. So we just ran through a whole bunch of them. What is good medical care? Do you think it, and I want you to vote on this, is it care that's consistent with knowledge? Is the goal to maximize the patient's duration of life, maximize the patient's quality of life, maximize the health of a population, or increase desired healthcare outcome? You can only vote for one. Vote for what you think is the most important measure of quality. Excuse me. Okay, got to get those votes up. Okay. So about half of you said, more than half said, maximize quality of life. Another 40% said increase desired health outcomes, and the others are smaller, almost non-existent. So there is no right answer here. What I want to emphasize is we talk glibly about quality of care, good quality care, high quality care. We rarely define it, certainly when we talk to each other and even when professionals talk to one another. And yet we've seen it isn't one factor. It's a multi-dimensional construct. It involves many different pieces that go together. So that makes it, so when we get to measurement and assessment of quality, we're going to see it's not quite that easy. If everything always moved in the same direction, if the best technical physician was in the best institution, had the best, most competent nurses, and they all had excellent communication skills, and they had good judgment, and they you got good outcomes, then life would be easy. But you know in life that most of life involves some trade-offs between things. And that's often the case when it comes to quality. So here are three common definitions of quality. This is from an article that David Blumenthal wrote about a while ago in New England Journal of Medicine in a series on quality that was there. Avitus Donabedian, one of the fathers of the quality improvement, quality care, quality improvement movement, define quality medical care as the kind of care which is expected to maximize patient welfare. The AMA defined care quality as care that consistently contributes to the improvement or maintenance of quality and duration of life. And the Institute of Medicine defined it as degree to which health services for individuals and populations increases the likelihood of desired health outcomes and so are consistent with current professional knowledge. You can see that as it's written by committees, it gets longer. But you can see that there is not one a congruence of what is quality. They're consistent with one another. They're not inconsistent with one another. But there are important subtle differences among them. Oops. So one way to think about quality is to think about how different people with different perspectives, people we'll call stakeholders. Stakeholders are people who have some skin in the game and who are being affected by the decision. So when we look at healthcare professionals and you talk to them traditionally about how they define quality, healthcare professionals tend to talk about the focus on the health of individuals, and that they tend to focus on technical attributes, appropriateness of care, and the skill with which it's provided. Sometimes physicians are still confused when they said, how could the care not be good quality? I did all the right things. But you may have done all the right things, but not the care still might not have been optimal, because it's the system has got to work right. And part of the doing the right thing is to make sure that people are communicating well and everybody knows their role and everybody is getting the right things done in the right way at the right time. But professionals tend to focus on the patient who they are caring for. That's the focus of our attention, especially when they're ill. Patients, on the other hand, tend to focus on outcome themselves and on functional outcomes, more so than providers generally do. We always often think about medicine, small m medicine, as life and death. In fact, the overwhelming majority of medical care is not life and death. It has to do with making people feel better and be able to engage more in the activities of life that they consider important. My patients all want to live longer, but they all have limits to how, they all have some point at which they have decided it's not worth living longer if they can't do certain other things or can't have some quality of life. Patients come to physicians and nurses and hospitals and healthcare providers because they want to feel better. They want to think more clearly. They want to sleep better. They want to be less anxious. They want to engage in activities of daily living. They want to be good parents, good spouses, good members of the community. They want to be able to play ball with their kids, see their kids recital, see their kids graduate from high school, get married, those sorts of things. Bail them out occasionally, whatever. And patients also, if we heard here, value highly provider interactions. Value how, do they trust their provider? That's very important, because you're giving up control. You have to trust that person. You can't just assume they know what they're doing. And that judgment of trust is based on how they communicate and respond to you. Is the system, are the providers, are the doctors and nurses responsive to your preferences and values, not their preferences and values? And do you have autonomy? Do you still have control of the final decisions? Those are all important elements to patients. Insurers and purchasers tend to focus on aggregate populations. That's what they do. They have to provide care to a population of patients, to the organization, to employees. And so they focus on these population organizational attributes, tend to focus on utilization and cost, complications, and general broad statistical outcomes. And then from the public health perspective, we focus on populations and communities, focusing on health maintenance and disease prevention as much as possible, where individual providers often tend to focus more on taking care of an acute problem because that's often what presents to them. So again, everything's in the eye of the beholder. Where you stand depends on where you sit, and different people have different expectations of the system. So the challenge we all face here in this class, and if we're thinking about running a healthcare system or we're thinking about trying to develop and reform a healthcare system for the country, is how to incorporate all these appropriately and balance them. So the Institute of Medicine, in a classic publication, Crossing the Quality Chasm, where they proposed elements that are needed for healthcare reform in the 20th century, which they published about a decade ago, came up with six core dimensions or factors of quality care. It should be safe, it should be effective, it should be patient-centered. That means the goal is to help the patient do what the patient wants done. In economics, we call this an agency relationship, where the provider, the doctor, the nurse, the system, the goal of all those groups are to help the patient, hope the patient get what the patient would want if the patient knew as much about the technical aspects of care as the provider does. Follow what I mean? In other words, that's what an agent does. You're supposed to represent the other person. That presupposes you know what the person's values are, what their preferences are, because you know I know the technical stuff. I know the disease, I know the treatment, I know the pathophysiology, but I have to learn from you what's important to you. quality care should be timely. You should be able to get it when you need it. It should be done efficiently. It shouldn't cost more than it should, than it needs to, because that's going to waste resources, and it should be fair and equitable. So those are the classic aspects of quality medical care. So how do we measure the quality of medical and health care? Donna Bedian, in a classic paper, broke it down into structure, process, and outcome. He said, for example, a high-quality hospital, you got to focus on administration, organization, and facilities. If your emergency room doesn't have an EKG machine or a defibrillator that works, if it's not safe, it could burn up at any moment, if the equipment isn't sterile, if people can't find what they need, if it isn't staffed appropriately, that can compromise quality. So structural aspects of the care providing site and system are important aspects of quality. They may not be sufficient, but they're necessary. Most of us would not want to go to a hospital where the doctors and nurses were not licensed and certified, right? Wouldn't want to take drugs that you didn't know had in the United States had the approval of the Food and Drug Administration. There are certain structural aspects that we expect. Don't want to go to a hospital there where you might get an infection, as opposed to when you came in without it. Then there's the process of delivering care. What does the process involve? Anybody know what we mean by process measures? Yeah. Right. Right. So sometimes we want to measure process. Did you do the right thing to the right patient at the right time, in the right way? That's a process measure. What did you do? We're not focusing on what happened. We're focusing on, did you do the right thing? And then there are outcomes. And the outcome is the result that's actually experienced by the patient. Which of these is most important? Yeah, the most important thing is, did the person get better, right? So do you think that when we measure quality, we always measure outcomes? No, we don't always measure outcomes. Why not? If we all agree that outcomes are what's most important. What? Yeah. What's your name? Alan? Alex. So Alex saying is they're difficult to measure. These things are easier to measure. And they often, if they're selected correctly, can be important. But outcomes can be difficult to measure. Because, Alex? Well, some of my colleagues who measure functional assessment could tell you, what are you with that, with the correct tools, we can just get as valid, reliable measures. But it does take more effort. It's not as apparent. And there are other issues what we'll get to. Yeah, lots of hands.
It's also difficult in terms of measuring outcomes with time, because sometimes the patient gets better
once they go. So again, it's more complex logistically, administratively. A lot of times, you'll treat somebody in the hospital, and whether or not they get better, you have to follow them for months. That takes effort that the system isn't currently often set up to do. Yeah. So even process can be difficult to measure sometimes. Yep. Anything else? Yeah. Right. So sometimes it isn't, outcomes may be the most important, but sometimes you'll get a good outcome even if things are done wrong, even if it's not done in a safe manner, and you still want to identify those because you might just have been lucky. Yeah? Okay, that's good. So come back to that, because I left that slide out. Go ahead. You were going to say that? Okay. So, what's the best measure? We talked about this. We're going to skip this audience response system because I screwed it up. Okay, who was the first person to systematically study patient outcomes from surgical procedures? Was it Ernest Codman, Malcolm Baldrige, Florence Nightingale, Avitus Donabedian, or Zeke Emanuel? So give me your best shot here. We're looking for four more votes here. I feel like I'm watching Family Feud here. Three more, come on. Just guess your last three, okay? It doesn't matter. Five, four, three, two, one. Boy, you guys invest a lot of ego in things that don't matter. Okay, what's the correct answer? 36% say Florence Nightingale, 23% say Malcolm Baldrige, 14% say Ernest Codman, 23% also say, so Baldrige and Donabedian are tied for second, Codman's third, or fourth, I guess, and last is Zeke. But at least Zeke got a couple votes. He'll be glad to know that when he gets back. Anybody know the correct answer or answers? Who said Florence Nightingale? A third of you said Florence Nightingale. Why'd you say that? Only woman on the list? Not really hand washing. In fact, there was a debate during much of her life whether she believed in germs or not. It was before the but it turns out she did. But anybody else have an answer for Florence Nightingale? Yeah, well, our nurse here. Yeah. Right. So during the Crimean War, Florence Nightingale, who's really the mother, I was going to say the father, the mother of modern nursing, she's a remarkable woman, did a lot of amazing things in her life. But she actually kept track of who got better and who got worse from various types of care during the Crimean War. So a lot of people would say that she was the first person to systematically study patient outcomes from surgical procedures. A lot of other people would say it's Ernest Codman. Who is Ernest Codman? Anybody know? Just like the name? Ernest Codman was a surgeon in the early 20th century at Massachusetts General Hospital, and he really systematically studied surgical outcomes. It's amazing what he did. Every patient he saw, he kept a card on, and he kept track of them for a full year. Think about this. I know this is hard for you to understand. No computers, no cell phones, no telephones. He tracked down what happened to all his patients for a full year. And then he expanded that to the Massachusetts General Hospital. Not only did he do that, but he felt that this information should be transparent. And when he first did his first study and showed that Massachusetts General had outstanding care, I forget what condition it was for, he was a local hero at his hospital. When he did subsequent studies that raised questions about the quality and appropriateness of the care that was provided by surgeons, he was ostracized and they tried to force him out. I can't remember whether they did or didn't. Now, of course, the surgeons offer a prize in his name. But he really was, so these are the two people, depending on your perspective, who I think legitimately could have gotten votes. Malcolm Baldrige, anybody know who he was? He was Secretary of Commerce under Ronald Reagan, remarkable person, and Secretary of Commerce. He made his Commerce Department more efficient, cut jobs, made it more efficient. A place, he was a quality expert. And the quality prize now for hospitals, a variety of for-profit and non-profit corporations, organizations, hospitals, whatever, healthcare systems, they now give a Malcolm Baldrige Award. It's the most prestigious award for quality management in the United States. Donabedian, we talked about, but he contributed a lot to how we think about quality, but he didn't actually work on fundamentally, systematically following it. And Zeke is a wonderful guy, and he probably would have done that if he had been there at the time, but these guys were older and were there first. So, okay, what's the best measure of hospital quality? It's another voting question. Is a complication as an event, deaths, failure to rescue, functional status, or readmissions? Which, if you were going to judge a hospital and you only had one thing to determine about quality, what would you choose? Yep. Don't say anything. Just vote. Yeah.
I just have a question. Wouldn't it depend on what type of hospital it is? Wouldn't like an orthopedic hospital versus like a regular community hospital have
Yeah. Incentives? Let's just say we're talking about a general hospital, okay? You're right. Everything, there are always qualifications. But for this question, again, just want to use this as a vehicle so we can sort of think about what the issues are and then talk about them. Okay? How many votes we got? Oh, we got 23. Almost everybody voted. That's good enough for me. About a third said complications. About said 30% said readmissions. About a quarter said 20% said functional status. 9% said deaths. 4% said failure rescue. And that person or two people, that person, did who voted said failure to rescue? I'm just curious. Do you know what it is? Okay. So many of us at Penn would actually say failure to rescue. Deaths are good sometimes if you adjust them for case mix. So we said case mix adjustment. What does that mean? That means you just can't compare hospital A to hospital B or doctor A to doctor B or outcome A to outcome B because some people might be sicker. In fact, when you first go to a hospital and you show them or a doctor, you show them that their outcomes are not as good as other people's outcomes for a given procedure or whatever, the first response you get are, my patients are sicker. That's what everybody always says. My patients are sicker. My patients are poorer. My patients don't have the social support. But you have to do something that we call case mix adjustment. And what case mix adjustment means is that we adjust for possible confounders. What does that mean? We adjust for factors that might bias the measurement in one way or the other. So what are some of the factors that we might want to case mix adjust for in general? Yeah? Well, let's say we're within a diagnosis code. Okay. Age. You break your leg, I break my leg. Who's going to get better faster on average? Don't be polite. Who's going to get better? Come on. You are. So you got to adjust for age. Right? Younger people heal better. Heal faster. Heal better. Yeah. Comorbidity. What else is going on besides, you know, if you have a heart attack and you're otherwise, quote, healthy, or you have a heart attack and you have diabetes, high blood pressure, and lung disease, you're probably going to do better with a simple, uncomplicated heart attack than an uncomplicated heart attack in a person who has all those other problems, which we call comorbid diseases. What else? Yep. Gender, sex, I never know which it is. Going to put them both down. If we weren't on tape, I'd say something. Go ahead. Yeah, my wife certainly would say something. Go ahead. Why socioeconomic status? Because we don't know often why. Sometimes we do. But poverty, lack of education, worse social support, those things all impair your ability to recover and get better. Yeah. I'm sorry, what? Race and ethnicity sometimes. This is a little bit more controversial. And sometimes so is sociodemographics. If we adjust for race or ethnicity, are we adjust for poverty? Are we therefore saying it's acceptable that poor people, underrepresented or vulnerable minorities, are it acceptable for them to have worse outcomes? Or do we say to the institution, we know it's harder, but your job, you're getting paid the big bucks to take care of patients, and you can't take care of them all as if they're wealthy, affluent people with good social support. You have to develop the services that provide more vulnerable people with the same level of care that otherwise people have on their own. So in one sense, these are correct. But in another sense, they can be problematic, particularly when you look at it from a policy perspective or a national perspective. We don't want to say in the United States that we're willing to have schools in poor school districts and poor areas not educate their kids as well as kids in more affluent areas. We know that's the way it is, but we constantly are working to try to reduce that inequality, and the same thing's true in healthcare. So on the one hand, to understand what's going on, you may and it's quote, and providers will often say that's not fair, and that's right to some degree, but from a policy perspective, it's more complex. Yeah. Length of illness. So there are other things going on. We might throw it into comorbidity. So there are a variety of things here that we could keep going on that are important, but these are the generally the major ones. I might be missing one, but these are the ones we most commonly, and sometimes we have things like stage of disease or severity of disease, which gets to whoever said ICD-9 code of the diagnosis. So somebody can come in with breast cancer, but is it early breast cancer or late breast cancer? We know, read the paper, there was in Science magazine the other day that, you know, the geneticists claim that by looking at the genetics of breast cancers, you can classify them all into four categories, and they're different from the normal staging procedures. And even what looks like an early cancer with bad pathology could turn out to have a very bad outcome. So we need to case mix adjust for the severity of illness or what we know about the prognosis. The one I want you to mostly learn, I want you to know these things, even though they won't be on a slide, but I think maybe we'll stick a slide in so you have it. But I want you to understand that it's important that all these things be case mix adjusted. We're not going to keep saying that all the way through. Okay. We said deaths are sort of good. Yeah, no, not good. But, you know, deaths, at least they're definitive. And we know we don't want people to die from medical care, right? So why don't we measure deaths more often? And that gets to this question. How many deaths are required to estimate a hospital's risk-adjusted mortality rate for a procedure which has a baseline death rate of 2.5%? So that means, on average, you expect about 2.5% of people who undergo this procedure to die. This would be a relatively high, David, would this be considered a high-risk surgical procedure? Yeah, 2.5% would be a high-risk surgical procedure. Most of us don't like taking those odds if we have to. But there are certain conditions where it's this or higher. But this is pretty high. How many people, so let's vote, how many deaths would you have to have in a hospital in a measurement period to be able to get a statistically valid, reliable estimate of the death rate? Say with a 5% confidence interval. Okay. Two more people? One more per? You got it. Okay. 1,500 people. A third of you say. 3,000 people, another third of you say. And then a bunch say 5,750. All these are big numbers. How many hospitals have that many deaths in a period? You would hope none. So in fact, Jeff Silber, who's a faculty member here in pediatrics and in healthcare management, has done a lot of work on this. He's the one who developed the failure to rescue metric. And he says, basically, if you have a 2.5% death rate, you have to have about 3,000 deaths per hospital to be able to say anything about that. That's more than hospitals have. So the problem with death rate is, while it's intuitively attractive, because if a hospital has a case mix adjusted higher mortality rate, there's probably very good reason to be worried about it. We don't have the level of confidence. Now expand this to, say, a primary care physician such as myself, who's not seen a lot of everything, seen a little of this, a little of that. I'm never going to have the volume to be able to reliably say how good I'm doing for any disease. Now, if I'm a diabetologist and I'm taking care of people with diabetes, I might be able to. If I'm an orthopedic surgeon who just does knees, you might be able to say something about my knees, how I'm doing with knees. But the more doctors do a variety of things, the smaller the numbers get, and the less reliable the statistical estimates get. So, and this is assuming a type 1 error. That means you're only 5% wrong in classifying a difference where there is none, and a type 2 error of 20%, which means you have only an 80% chance of not missing an important effect if it's there. Okay, so we said we can't measure deaths. We'd like to measure something else. A lot of times people say if you can't measure deaths, measure what? Complications. Because complications are also something we want to avoid. That would be good if complications correlate high with hospital rankings. So that's something that we're all excited about. Tell me how high you think the correlation is between hospitals ranked on death rate and hospital ranked on complication rates. So you're a company, you're going in and measuring how good a hospital is, you're measuring its death rate, you're measuring its complication rate. And then you rank all the hospitals based by their death rate, then you re-rank all the hospitals based on their complication rates. How highly correlated do you think those two lists are going to be? Very high, high, modest, low, or very low? Come on, four more votes. 3, 2. Somebody's thinking hard about this. Okay. low. Most of you said low. 40% of you said low. Quarter said modest. A third said high. And the answer is, what do you think? Not very good. This is work that Jeff Silber and his colleagues did, published about 17 years ago now. And it shows that there's very little correlation at that time between ranking hospitals for death and ranking for complications, which is a little bit discouraging. Because it would be nice to be able to do this, because complications are easy to get. They're coded on the front sheet of a hospital discharge. So they're easy to get. They're computerized. But unfortunately, it doesn't correlate well with ranking for death, which would cause us to ask what's wrong with this picture, because they both can't be right. However, having said this, these are the two ways that people often feel most comfortable ranking hospital quality. Okay, let's shift terms a little bit. How does the U.S. do in terms of quality? Which of the following causes the most U.S. deaths annually? AIDS, auto accidents, breast cancer, or medical errors? You have 5 seconds to vote. Boy, the last two people really have problems making decisions, right? My wife always says on my tombstone, I'll say he kept his options open. But you two really would give me a run for my money. Oops. Do we not? Oh, there it is. Okay. 43% said medical errors, 17% said breast cancer, 40% said auto accidents. The right answer? Right? It's a quality lecture. It's got to be medical. No, it doesn't. Zeke would have tricked you. But actually more people now die of breast cancer than auto accidents. We have a decrease in auto accidents in the United States. I think, I'm not sure. Do you know, Andrew? I think auto accidents are somewhere now in the range of 35 to 40,000. It had been as high as 50,000, and I think that's pretty much what breast cancer deaths are. HIV is actually much lower. It's got a higher case mortality rate, but very many fewer people get it. And AIDS has, death rates of AIDS have really come down remarkably with regard to treatment. So the answer is medical errors, and we're going to walk through that in a second. I was just reading an article in the New York Times. I've heard this number before, so of course I'm going to get it wrong. But something like the number of deaths in the United States due to medical errors is like one or two 747 a day crashing and killing everybody on board. Now, if that happened, how often do you get a fatal airplane crash in the United States? Last number I saw was about 1 in 10 million, maybe lower than that. That was old data, and I don't think there's been a fatal airplane crash in the United States for 2 or 3 years now, of a scheduled airline. So, and yet most of us at least think a little bit when we get on an airplane occasionally. Most of us don't think that much about medical errors, but in fact, 1 to 2 747s a day, that would get our attention, right? That would make all the news stations. But because it's happening, a death here, a death there, sometimes we're not aware of it, it doesn't have the salience, it doesn't have the impact. Approximately what percent of hospitalized Medicare patients experience a serious adverse event, i.e. a complication? 1.5%, 5%, 13.5%, or 27%? I didn't give you a lot of middle numbers here. It's either low or high. So we talked about deaths, and those death rates are in the range of a percent or a fraction of a percent. We're back up to 22 again. 23. Whoever's 23 and 24, let's meet after class. We have a lot in common, okay? I was once president of a group called the Society for Medical Decision Making. We study how to make medical decisions and make them better. And we had a board meeting, a mid-year board meeting at our house, because it was a low-budget operation. So everybody flew in, stayed with friends, and then we met at my house. And my wife came out to, you know, give us drinks or something, and she called me and she said, "What's the name of this group?" I said, "The Society for Medical Decision Making." She said, "I've never seen a group of people who can't make a decision like this group." So 23, 24, we got to get together here. About 48% of you said 13.5%, 22% said 27%, 22% said 5%. The right answer, depending on how you look at it, is 13.5% or 27%. And why do I say that? This is from a study done by Dr. Levinson at the Office of the Inspector General of the United States, which basically is an internal investigative group. And he looked at adverse events in hospitals, a national incidence among Medicare beneficiaries. A study relatively recent, came out 2 years ago. He found that 13.5% of Medicare beneficiaries who were hospitalized experienced an adverse event during their hospital stay. This was a serious event that caused them some harm. So that's where the 13.5% number comes. 27% number comes, another 13.5% experienced results resulting in temporary harm. They had harm, but they recovered from it, and usually without any sequela. So depending on how you look at it, somewhere between 13.5% and 27% of people who are Medicare beneficiaries suffer a complication when they get in the hospital. Now, what's wrong with that picture? Why is it wrong to say, to conclude, therefore, that hospitals and doctors and nurses cause 27% of injuries in 27% of patients? Yeah? Right. You don't know about causality. We're just reporting an observation. But in this particular case, what they did is they got a bunch of doctors together, blinded them to specifics about the case, gave them the key information of the case, and these panels of doctors concluded that 44% of the time, these complications could have or should have been prevented. So about 40% or more of these 27%. So what's 40% of 27%? Anybody know? It's about 12%, give or take. 12% of people suffer preventable harm. And this is not inexpensive. In 2008, they estimated this cost $324 million just to care for those complications. So we have some issues here. The classic study was done by Troy Brennan and Lucian Leap. They did this together. They did a couple studies. It was actually a study not looking at hospital quality. This is the most widely quoted study of hospital quality, but it wasn't a study of hospital quality. It's actually a study of malpractice. They were trying to figure out what percentage of malpractice claims actually were due to malpractice, as opposed to people just having bad outcomes, perhaps by chance. As part of that, they went to Utah and Colorado separately. They reviewed all the charts of people in the hospitals, or at least a large sample of them, I don't remember which. They looked at who sued for malpractice and who didn't, who was found guilty of malpractice. But the real impact was not on the research was not on malpractice. It turned out to be quality, because in the process, they estimated the rate of adverse events which were caused by clinical care in hospitals in these states. And it varied. I'm sorry, it was New York and Colorado, Utah, not Colorado, Utah were one, New York was another. And they were done in different years. But you can see in New York, 3.7% of hospitalized patients had an adverse event. And 13.6 of those led to death. In Utah and Colorado, it was a little bit lower. 2.9% of patients had an adverse event, and only 8% of them led to death. You do the math of these, and you can end up with what the deaths due to errors were. And this is where the common estimate of 50 to 100,000 people die a year of medical errors come from. So it comes from these two studies. If you take these studies and extrapolate them to all hospitals and things like that, and you assume that nothing has changed for the better or the worse in the last 20 to 30 years, you get 50 to 100,000. Now, that's a fairly wide range, 50 to 100,000. But even 50,000 is considered to be a large number by most of us who have the responsibility of caring for people and trying to make them better. So this is, and this led to a publication by the Institute of Medicine on medical errors and how to improve it, called "To Err Is Human." If you're really interested in this, another important landmark study that you should read. It doesn't present original data, but it does a nice job of summarizing the information that was known at that time, at the time "To Err Is Human" was published. So how dangerous is healthcare? Less than one death per 100,000 encounters occurs for nuclear power or scheduled airlines. And I think the scheduled airline number is actually much smaller now. Less than one death in 100,000, but more than one in 1,000 occurs from driving. Any parent who has kids who are driving, that's your greatest fear when they're in high school or college, is when they go out with a car until they get home. Or chemical manufacturing, which most of us would consider to be a fairly hazardous business. There's more than one death per 1,000 encounters for bungee jumping, mountain climbing, medical care. How many people here would have put medical care into the bungee jumping, mountain climbing thing? Next time you're going bungee jumping or mountain climbing, your parents don't like it, say, well, you go to the hospital. You know, so why should I climb a mountain, right? This is a real number. It's best we can determine. So we're talking about quality. I think the picture, we're talking about the U.S. and we're focusing on problems here. That's what the purpose of the course is, to learn how to improve and reform the system. I would say, without having a lot of empirical data, because there isn't any, if I were sick and I needed acute medical care, I can't think of another place I'd rather be hospitalized than in the U.S. if I had access to full range of care. Recognizing that I might get overly treated sometimes and might suffer from that. But as a healthcare system as a whole, how do we do? Are we near the top, in the middle, or near the bottom compared to other highly industrialized, wealthier countries? And these are like the OECD countries. 15, 18. You just want to see if I can count, right? Let's get up to 22 and then we can wait. Okay, we're going to go on. And in fact, that's where we are. So, if we look at in-hospital case fatality rates 30 days after admissions for acute myocardial infarction, why do everybody use OECD data? Because it's there. Every country reports, all these countries report to OECD using reasonably consistent information. You can't compare them exactly. Collect their cases the same way. Some have higher collecting data than others. But those are not thought to be major. Inpatient fatality rates are at the high end, and here we're down with Latvia, Korea, and Mexico, not up with New Zealand, Austria, Denmark. The United States is down here, but it's certainly not at the top. Death is a pretty more in the middle. And you can see these countries along the bottom. You can see, pick your favorite. Norway. Pretty well, huh? Because health and life expectancy is a lot of things. To the degree, every time determined by other socioeconomics, opportunity.
Breast cancer survival in the United States is about as good as you get. We're again at the top. So, what are some of the causes of poor quality of care? Well, we talk about three types of misutilization. We talk about overuse, misuse, or technical errors, and underuse. And there's a lot of evidence to suggest that there is indeed misutilization. We're going to talk about a couple of them. There are unexplained variations in care. We'll talk about that in a minute. There are deviations from guidelines and standards. We'll talk about that. We know we're not going to talk about, I'm not going to provide any details right now on these last two, but we do know that when we change the way we pay people, the way they're taking care of changes. And if we really practice evidence-based medicine and we're doing with the patient all the time, patterns of care would not change in response to patterns of reimbursement. So that gets to be our answer about paying. It certainly helps to align your incentives. And you'll see when we get to the Affordable Care Act that a lot of the initiatives are about aligning incentives. If we say quality is important, pay for quality. If we say that what you do doesn't count as much what happens to patients, pay less for what you do, pay more for what happens to patients. And we also see significant variations in outcomes by patients and physicians. And again, yeah, just for time purposes, we're not going to go through this. This is a map of the United States. You can see this comes from the Dartmouth Atlas, Dartmouth University. Our colleagues up there have done landmark work for the last 20 years looking at variations in care. It goes back to the 1970s when Jack Weinberg wrote an article with Gittleson on small area variations in the state of Vermont. And they showed that when you went to Vermont, small state, small population, county to county, there were dramatic differences in the rates in which different things were done. And you couldn't explain them by the people there. And you adjusted for age and gender and all these other things. Those variations remained larger than could be explained by anything, and they concluded that these must be choice variations based on preferences of doctors. And you can see that there are this is inpatient hospitalization services, hospital services for Medicare enrollees, and it varies dramatically depending on where you live in the United States. In some areas, there is a very low rate of hospitalization. This is the population adjusted, the amount of money, and in others, it's very high. We can't explain, we don't know if higher is better or lower is worse or vice versa, but we know they all can't be right. If we look at these variations in care, just to give you a number, Medicare spending, Miami, we pay about, this was when this came out, and I think this was about 4 years ago, 5 years ago, Miami spent more than twice as much as Minneapolis per Medicare beneficiary a year without any clear evidence that the people in Miami were any healthier. Now, there might be other reasons. It could be unhealthier people tend to go south and be in Miami. You have to be careful with this type of data. You know, cross-sectional data. I always say if you did a cross-sectional study of South Florida, you would conclude that everybody's born Hispanic and dies Jewish. It could be misleading at times. But again, it's hard. If we're talking here, the difference between 7,900 and 8,200 and 7,000 and 8,000, there are a lot of things, but it's hard to account for twice the rate of spending differences in the absence of any clear differences in outcomes. Why would be causing these? According to the Dartmouth group, what is the primary cause of Medicare variation? What do these investigators think? Do they think it's due to system capacity differences in reimbursement, patient preferences, physician-patient preferences, or training and environment? And I'll give you 5 seconds to go. We're a few minutes late for getting started, but I want to end you on time. Oops. So a lot of you said, a third of you said physician preferences, probably because I mentioned that a minute ago, they actually think it's due to system capacity. If you build hospital beds, they will be used. If you have a lot of doctors, they will stay busy. If you have 4 orthopedic surgeons, you're going to need a fifth. If you have 1, you may need a second. So their feeling is, all these are important, by the way. They all are important. There is not a wrong answer here. But they think that system capacity and physician preferences are probably the most important, supported by reimbursement and training and environment. Yeah.
So they calculate we have excess supply.
Yeah. Excess supply. Which is interesting, but it doesn't explain everything, because there are fewer hospital beds. David and I were talking earlier, there are fewer hospital beds in the United States than there are in Europe, and we have shorter length of stays, and we have to spend more money. So it's not quite that simple, certainly, they often, I don't want to minimize this, we'll get to this in a second, but physician preferences are very important. So, this is a complicated chart, I'm going to spend a minute going through it because we have three figures that show the same thing. This basically shows the highest versus lowest spending region, and one means they provide these procedures at about the same rate. There's no difference between high and slow spending regions. And you can see that when you look at people who get coronary angiography, get their arteries looked at in appropriate cases, when you look at people getting angioplasty or bypass surgery, when you look at people who get cholecystectomy and hernias and get their hip replaced or their knee replaced, that these pretty much are similar between high and low spending areas. And when you go to what they call, and then what they would argue is there's a fairly good consensus about who should and shouldn't get those things. But there are these things they call supply sensitive care, and you can see that there is a lot of variation here, and there is much, you're much more likely to get these in high spending areas than in low spending areas. So the high spending is not driven across the board. There's some things that there seems to be a culture and a preference and a general consensus about what should be done and how frequently it should be done and what types of patients. And there are some where there's more wide variation. And they suggest that this is sensitive to supply. And what do they mean by supply? When you look at more hospital beds, you hospitalize more patients, more doctors, and more specialists, you hospitalize more patients. And boy, you are good, Andrew. I gave Andrew the slide and I spent hours trying to get the black font of the dark background. I could not get it. He had about an hour or two to work with it. And I'm taking you home.
I can give you lessons.
You sure do, yeah. I'm not sure I can afford it, but we'll try. But you can see here that there's a pretty good correlation between the number of cardiologists per 100,000 people in an area and the number of visits to cardiologists. Now, it could be that the cardiologists are going where they're needed. We don't really have a whole lot of evidence to suggest why one town needs a lot of cardiologists and the next county over doesn't. And when we look at the percentage of patients for whom physicians would recommend specific interventions, you see there are some, like if you have a person who has angina, chest pain on exertion, would you refer somebody to a cardiologist for a stress test? Almost everybody would. But you look at this and you see that there are significant variations, bigger variations between whether you would give a drug for a high cholesterol, or whether you would do an MRI for back pain and foot drop, or a PSA test. So there are some things where there is there's a difference between the areas and there are some where there are not. There are preference-sensitive conditions and there are supply-sensitive conditions. They are both thought to be important factors. Now, this is controversial. The Dartmouth group originally sometimes would say, and a lot of people would interpret, that in the absence of any demonstrated differences in quality, therefore high-spending regions must be providing worse care because you're doing more, you're spending more, and you don't see differences in outcomes. It's important to note that the Dartmouth group has not rigorously looked across the board at the relationship between variations in spending and utilization, which they have demonstrated very, very carefully, and I think it was without doubt, and how that compares to outcomes. This slide shows some people who take issues with the association of variations in care with quality, and say when you look at state spending, because the Dartmouth work is all done on Medicare spending, or almost all done on Medicare spending, that when you do that, you can't say anything about quality. So this is a story that's still being played out. Having said that, I think most people think that's too simplistic to say it's all directly related to quality. There may not be any quality differences. But in the end, I mean, most people in absence of clear information right now feel that there's really something to the story, at least some of them. So Dartmouth's conclusions, I got this from Elliot Fisher, who's one of the leading investigators at Dartmouth and is a colleague of mine. Their conclusions are that clinical evidence, and it isn't because doctors are bad, they're saying that clinical evidence and principles are important, but they have a limited influence on decision making. A lot of other factors go into making a decision just than evidence. We do not practice evidence-based medicine solely because we have to make a lot of other judgments. Some of those judgments are appropriately modified, we modify the evidence. Some we inappropriately modify the evidence, either subconsciously, due to heuristics and biases, psychological ways we handle information, some because of self-interest or where your incentives are aligned, and incentives are not just financial incentives, they may be what the patient wants. What the patient wants may not always be the right thing to do. Maybe what the doctor wants may not always be what the patient wants or what's best for the patients. Physicians practice in a local organizational context and policy environment that profoundly influences their decision making. You can't remove somebody from the organization, the environment, the context, and culture in which they practice. So if we're going to change the way people practice, we're going to change the way care is delivered, we have to change the culture, we have to change the organization, we have to change the environment. In addition, our payment system, everybody agrees that our payment system distorts care, that what we pay for, we get more of, but we don't pay for everything. The things we pay more for are not necessarily the most valuable things. That's true throughout society. I think most people would say, well, it's not popular in this political environment, that teachers are doing one of the most important jobs. I think it's a hard job. Try being in a classroom from 8 in the morning until 3:30 in the afternoon and not even be able to go to the bathroom because you can't leave your kids alone. You know, it's a tough job. There's work outside of work. We don't pay teachers enough. And yet we pay people who are doing things that we think are socially marginal or even contrary to social benefit more. So payment system here fosters growth and incentivizes high use of capacity. If you buy it, you want to use it because you've paid for it and you can get a lot of money for using it. So they conclude that reasonable individual clinical and local decisions lead, in the aggregate, to higher utilization rates, greater costs, and inadvertently, sometimes worse outcomes. And I should have put sometimes, okay? Reasonable individuals, not bad people, in localities, in the aggregate, not everybody, but there are a lot of things in the system and the culture and the environment and the payment that encourage us to do more rather than less. When to the degree that doing more is good, that's good, but to the degree that it isn't, it causes problems. Okay, we're just about done. What percentage of Americans receive care recommended by experts? Respond quickly. And the answer seems to be in this group 50 to 70%. If we look at a RAND study from 2006, and they took guidelines that experts came up with, and there was good consensus in the United States, they found that there was good clinical control, somewhere between 40 and 65%, depending on the condition. About 2/3 of people with hypertension had good clinical control, only about 1/2 of people with asthma, and only 40% of people with community-acquired pneumonia were treated according to standards. None of these are rocket scientists. None of these are hard science. None of these are hard. So another reason to suspect that our quality is not what it's up to is because we don't do what we all agree we should be doing at the rates we should be doing. What's the most common cause of hospital adverse events? The diagnostic errors, drug treatment, surgery, or non-surgical drug therapy? And everybody tends to think that when we do these things, it's due to an error that was made at the time of the surgery, the procedure. In fact, diagnostic codes, as you guys noted, are the most common cause of this. So why do errors happen? All people make errors. In fact, as the Institute of Medicine noted, the ability to make an error, mistakes, allows us to function. We couldn't function if we didn't make errors, because we'd be paralyzed by decisions that never getting done. And human factor research shows that errors are inevitable, because medicine is complex and uncertain, but that it's not because the people are bad, it's because the system is bad. Go into a hospital, go to a doctor's office, you'll see how complex it is. And training is difficult, the hours are long, the workplaces are poorly designed, there are often a lack of check and balances. It's these system errors. When you look at the complexity of the system, you know something's gonna go wrong. There's just so many steps. Many of them are not necessary. We know to the degree, like the rest of business, if we can simplify our organization, if we can simplify our processes, we can reduce our errors. And so they concluded that healthcare is not trying to make itself safe. So I'm going to skip this. The key point I want to just mention here is that we haven't done a good job in assessing things. We have misaligned our incentives. So we have these gaps, and the structure does not make best use of the resources. I want to just go two more things. How can we improve care? In general, we focused on the bad apple approach. We say, this is the distribution of people and the quality of care they provide. Let's focus on the people with the extreme who are providing bad quality care. If we do that, look how much we can get rid of in terms of bad quality care. Okay? That's the bad apple approach. That's when you try to weed people out who are doing things wrong. And besides being not very effective, it leads to a cycle of fear. People are not very forthcoming about making errors and then working together to figure out how to reduce that error. If, especially if errors are due to systems, you have to do that if people think that they're going to be punished or looked down upon. In fact, it's been accepted now in most other services and industries that you get a lot more gain, all this gain. If you move the whole curve just a little bit, you get a lot more gain than if you go after the bad apple. And you could, that means, and how do you do that? You reduce unnecessary variation. You create a learning environment where a problem occurs, people figure out what went wrong, let's figure out how we together can make sure this problem doesn't happen again. And it's amazing, the people closest to the work are the ones who often understand how the system works best and can fix it best. Your goal is to improve the system, not punish the individual. And the worry is not, am I going to be penalized, it's, am I being the best I can be? Everybody, no matter how good you are, can always get better. If everybody tries to get a little bit better, there's a lot more gain. So, the IOM said we have to redesign care processes and develop effective teams that coordinates care and uses performance management with systems reengineering and enhanced accountability that I'll let you read on your own. So, what I wanted to end with is while the U.S. medical system does much well and has improved prevention, early detection, and outcomes, in fact, life expectancy has increased remarkably in this country every decade for the last 3 or 4 decades. People are living much longer, much healthier. It's not just we're extending people's lives, we're extending their healthy years of life predominantly. People are not having many more years or any more years of bad health. It's just we're pushing them up further into the future. So I don't want to give you the sense that the healthcare system is not doing a good job in a lot of ways, but we're not doing as well as we could be doing. We could be doing better. That's because most medical errors are caused by defective systems. And if we're going to improve healthcare, we have to redesign and improve medical care systems to improve the safety, effectiveness, efficiency. And you will see when we get back to the Affordable Care Act, some of the initiatives that it takes, and this may be one of the most interesting and encouraging aspects of the Act, and where there's probably the greatest consensus among the various political beliefs that this is something that we should be doing and investing in. Okay, you guys are welcome, free to go. If anybody has any questions, you can take them, or we can just come back and ask them.